Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Now we're live. We're live.
Ooh, we're live.
We are live from
live.
Atlanta, Georgia. Well, not Atlanta. We're in Roswell. What's up, man?
What's up with you, man?
This is your first. You've broke the COVID seal.
Just to come check you.
Just to come here.
Yeah, man.
That's amazing.
You know, it's a blessing for me, man. I tell you, it's there's something about...
Oh.
What do you want me to do? Oh. I'll tell you, like, you got a little smudge. 1-2, 1-2.
There you go.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, it's a real blessing to be out of the house, man. Because I'm telling you, I've been on lockdown since March.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm about ready. You know, I'm taking a trip to Florida in a couple of weeks. My sister just bought a house there, and she offered an area of the house for me to set up a studio.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's my next pursuit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that. So when I heard from you, I was like, yeah, okay. I got to connect with you anyway, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you were like, yo, let's talk. And I'm here, man. Let's chop
let's
it
do
up.
It. Yeah, you know? We were talking about doing it, and... I wasn't making any kind of schedule. I was kind of trying a new format out and trying to learn, like, my voice and stuff like that. And so, yeah, we're about to take a trip, too, on Tuesday. Me, Kirk, and Adam are jumping in an RV and driving to Montana.
What? I want to go.
And we're going to meet a friend out there who has an underground bunker. And he's brought four or five addicts. One guy who was kicking heroin on the way there.
Ooh.
And they're renovating this underground bunker to turn it into an Airbnb.
Wow, underground?
And, yeah.
Airbnb?
Yeah, in Montana. So we're going to go, we're going to film some of that, and then we're going to film on the way there and make a documentary out of the trip.
Wow. Yeah, man, make room, man. I'll come. I'll roll. I'll be down for real.
I know, right?
I would love that.
Yeah, that's a real blessing to be able to do something like that. So if anybody doesn't know, like today we're talking about recovery, about race, about God. Maybe. We'll see how it goes.
Always God, man.
Always.
Always God.
So you've been doing this recovery thing for a while, right? I mean, one day at a time, but a couple days in a row, right?
Yeah, man. Please pray for me. My name is Troy. I am an alcoholic, an addict, and a million other things. And my recovery date is August 22nd, 2000. And I'm, you know, happy to be here today, live and direct, you know.
Yeah.
And still walking.
Man, that's a little bit of time there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, that one day at a time thing.
Yeah.
It this is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not trying to get caught up in the future, you know.
Yeah.
Because initially I was been thankful to just be sober for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then once I got to that year, I wasn't the same man that wanted a year.
Right.
That year changed me into another human being.
Yeah.
You know, and that human being wanted to maintain and sustain
a
life of recovery.
Yeah. You
know, that's where the blessing started for me is after that first year.
Yeah.
You know, I saw me make it there.
Right.
And I understood that I couldn't have done it without God. And so I wanted to know more about this entity. I wanted to know more about how God works in our lives.
Yeah.
You know, and it was put to me real simple. If you really want to find God, look for God in others.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
So that really connected me to 12-step meetings because you know, I go to a 12-step meeting and I get a chance to meet that little bit of God in you and you, and you guys get a chance to see the little bit of God in me.
Yeah.
And it conspires to keep us sober one day at a time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just that God connection, you know. So the unity piece of recovery has had a great impact.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
You said something, I don't know if it was when we were recording a Clean Dreams or something, but it was essentially, I think you said, like, basically, I don't have to drink, I don't have to stay sober the rest of my life.
Just today.
Just today. And when you said that, it just kind of like, it really resonated with me, because I think like, a lot of us, when we enter into the recovery world, that's what we think. We think, oh, this is the rest of my life.
That's a scary proposition right
there. Oh, my God. Yes, it is.
That's a scary proposition.
Anything for the rest of your life is scary, right? Yeah. So I really like that. It's like, I don't have to stay sober the rest of my life, just today.
Yeah.
And it's it feels like a dangerous thought, but it's also a very freeing thought, because you go, oh, today?
Yeah. And I give that away. I can do that. I can give that away one day at a time. Like if for instance I'm working with a new man, how I usually phrase it is that all I got to do is stay sober till 12 midnight. That's all I got to do. Stay sober till 12 midnight. You know, all we do are today's, and at 12 midnight it becomes today again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't have to worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to take care of itself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If I just focus, as it regards my recovery, if I just focus on today's, you know, I'll be okay. Now, as it regards my IRA, I got to think in terms of, you know, I got to be more futuristic than
that. Right.
As it regards my child's, you know, upbringing and those types of things, I got to be more futuristic than that.
Right.
But as it regards my recovery,
yeah,
you know, we're doing that one day at a time.
Yeah, and that was when in the seminary, you know, I just graduated from.
Congratulations, brother.
Thank you. Which was an amazing journey the last 2 years, but there was years before that that even set me on that path. But we had to write our own vows and take our own vows. Which I thought was a really powerful experience. And one of the things I kept struggling with was about creating a vow that took me out of the day. Like that I would have a vow that wouldn't allow me to be like the third step or the seventh step, wouldn't allow me to be of service to however God wanted me to be of service today, which might just be doing the dishes or being nice to my wife or answering the phone. It might not be some magical, mystical tour. You know what I mean?
And so to Montana.
Right, exactly. So I was really, and it took me a long time to finally write the vow. In true alcoholic fashion, I wrote it a couple hours before the ordination, because, but when it hit me, right? I got it. And that was important for me, to put one moment at a time and one day at a time in there, so that I'm always checking myself to the here and now.
Yeah.
Because that's dangerous when we start getting to that projection and we think in, especially with things of spiritual nature, which recovery is spiritual, you know, when we think of things in spiritual nature and we start kind of having these projections, man.
You see, the minute I start projecting, I am outside. I'd like to think that God is in the right now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not in the past and he's not in the future. You know what I mean? He is in the right now. He's in the business of right now. What are you doing? Are you being of service? Are you being truthful and transparent? Are you recognizing me? You know?
Right.
Because the minute I go out into the future, I leave God here. You know what I mean? And doing that in itself is dishonoring God.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I honor God when I stay in the moment and see the people he's got me around right now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And how can I be of maximum service right now?
Yeah. Yeah. And what I've learned over the last couple of years is a lot of spiritual practices, just the word spiritual practice, right? That to keep us in the now. That's a very important part of, and we've kind of lost touch, but thank God for 12 steps and the community. So some questions I have. Well, here's one of the things I have a question is, like, I know that, like you said, you work with men who need, or early on and need help, or wherever they're at, who need help, kind of being of service.
I work with women too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that really need being of service. And what has that been like for you?
Good days and bad days, because you know recovery is a it's a worthy endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just as worthy as addiction is an enemy.
Yeah,
you know. So I'm going to have samples and examples of both, you know, the death and the success, you know. I've got that.
You're hearing some kid crying or something.
I've got that. I've got the experience of burying a lot of men, you know. But I've also got the experience of seeing a lot of men really go through the process and succeed and live very, very nice lives, you know what I mean? What that has done is really given me a respect for the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction.
Yeah.
You know, and...
I mean, how do you deal with that when you have... You know, we were having this conversation last night about it. It's like when you're working with someone and they're not taking instruction and they're kind of deciding to go their own way, and then you kind of watch them and then you see them self-destruct.
That's not the hard guy. That's not that. The hard guy is the guy who's doing everything.
Mm.
You know what I mean? He's doing everything. He's attending meetings. You know, he's staying in contact with you. You know.
Yeah.
And then, for a millisecond, his disease has him. You know, whether it's in the car or you know, or at the job or you know, because they have to go live.
Right.
You know what I mean? I liken this to, you know. You get into a shower and it's beautiful. It feels great and mm-hmm. it's nice, but you know, as nice as it is, you still gotta get out and go live your life. You know, you can't stay in that shower forever.
Right.
It feels good,
right.
But you can't stay in that shower forever. Well, the same is true as you sit with a man and you discuss, you know, his steps and you discuss him, you know, reaching out and helping others.
Yeah.
You know, go do it, you know. But once they leave you, you know, they still have that voice in their head that sounds just like them telling them, you know, man, we could have just one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And if they succumb to that, and some do, you know, to never come back and say, hey, man, I made a mistake. I'd rather have a guy come back and say, man, I made a mistake. I relapsed, man. So I know, you know, all right, man.
Let's
get back. Yeah. Let's get it back, you know.
Yeah.
But that doesn't always happen. Sometimes they never make it back.
Yeah. That's like I tell my kids, like, I can't help you if you're lying to me.
Right.
You know, because there's nothing I can do. But as soon as you come out of that, mm-hmm. and you bring it to light, now we can work with it. I can help you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's material there.
There's some, there's material there.
And I know that relapse changes a person.
Right.
You know what I mean? Sometimes it takes 20 relapses for a person to change.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I've seen that happen. And then once the change occurs, you nurture it.
Yeah.
You know, you feed it. God is there, right there in the middle of it, you know. And it may seem sometimes like a challenge or a struggle.
Yeah.
But I assure you that it's okay to struggle if you're in a program of recovery.
Yeah.
Because in the struggle is the 12 steps, is sponsorship, is a network, is God. These things are in the struggle with you. You're not in the struggle by yourself.
Right.
You know? But that decision maker in your head, you know, if he gets you alone somewhere, you know, in that corner, you know, and tosses a suggestion up to you, and it's a perfect storm, it lines up perfectly, you're able to access it, and there you go, you're off and running.
Yeah, that's why I like the concept of the next right thing, because if you do make a mistake, you do something, it's just, okay, what's the next right thing is to make that call. But so many of us, it's that guilt and the shame and the whole expectations we put on ourselves, you know, that we think we got to do this for the rest of our lives. And then when you make a mistake, instead of correcting it quickly, because that's the thing is, like, if you do relapse, it doesn't mean you have to go on a 6-month bender now.
Right.
Like, and cause twice as much damage as you had before.
But shame is a thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And some people stay out there because they're ashamed to come back.
Yeah.
You know, and they look at going up there and picking up another white chip as that walk of shame.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's just not true. But if it's a belief system, that belief system has to come crumbling down. And usually that doesn't happen until you hit a good, nice, solid bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
They always clap every time you pick up that white chip, though. So,
yeah, you're helping.
We might be judging you slightly in our heads, but we're clapping out loud.
We're happy, though, that you're coming back, that you made it. You know, exactly. You made it back.
Yeah.
You know, that speaks to the power of God.
Yeah.
You know, I know that I could not do it by myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's part of the reason that I'm still here today.
Yeah.
Having that clear understanding, removing all doubt that you did not do this by yourself, right, bro. You had a little help.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And how do you honor that? Yeah.
Yeah, man. So I don't know how you want to, if you want to share any stories, but I love your stories. What I wanted to get, if I could get, is your craziest story before recovery. And your craziest story in recovery. Because I know that in recovery, you dealt with some things as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, what kind of got you to the place, in some of that, those hijinks before you were like, okay, finally, like, all right, I'm going to do this.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And we are live on
there
Facebook.
There are so many, but the one that, when you brought that up, the one that really jumped out was my friend Lionel and I used to go up on Long Island. I'm from New York.
Okay.
Right? I grew up in Queens and Brooklyn, and right around the corner from our house in Queens, there was a Long Island Railroad station.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the kids just used to kind of gather there because there were walls. So we would play handball under the trestle. I don't know if you know where the trestle is. Y'all might not. The trestle is the train goes up above.
Oh, above the train.
It's like a bridge, but under that trestle is a street.
Okay, yeah.
All right, instead of water or any other type of landscape, it's a street. So we call that a trestle, right? And the train ran through our neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
but it ran up on an elevated trestle. So under the trestle, we play handball, you know, and just outside of the trestle, we play baseball. You know, we created bases on the block, you know. Everything was in the street.
Right.
We played basketball in the street. We played handball, baseball, every football, everything we played in the street.
Yeah.
And my friend Lionel and I, we would hang, you know what I mean? And we go up on the tracks, because under the track itself, under the platform itself, that's where the workmen kept their tools and stuff like that. There was stuff to mess with, you know what I mean? So I'm like 14 or 15, and we're up there, we're smoking weed, we're drinking, and we're throwing rocks at this abandoned warehouse, which is like about 100 feet past the train tracks. And you got to get just the right rock to make it sail into the window and bow, explode. So he's on one side of the platform, and I'm on the other side of the platform, and we're both walking down the tracks looking for the right rock.
Yeah.
And he's on the other side, I'm on this side, and all of a sudden, I'm looking down, but I heard Lionel say, "Troy," and I look up, and the train was right here.
Oh.
And all I could do is fall back. And the train just like, and it passed.
Wow.
Right? And Lionel comes running over to me, and I'm like, "Man, thank you." He's like, "Thank you for what?" I said, "For calling me." He said, "I didn't call you." I said, "You did. You called me. That's why I looked up." He's like, "No, I didn't call you, man."
Wow.
To this day, we talk about that.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And I say it often, but a lot of my spiritual experiences happened while I was getting high.
Yeah, right.
But I was spiritually asleep.
Yeah.
So I was unable to see it.
Yeah.
But coming into this program, these steps have awakened me. in such a way that I can look back in my life and see the hand of God.
Yeah, right.
Now, I can't describe his face, you know, but I can damn sure describe his hand.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. I know that I know that I know.
Yeah.
That was the hand of God.
Yeah. That's crazy, man. Yeah. That's, I'm like visualizing the whole thing. We need to do, we were talking about doing dramatizations of, we need to do a dramatization of that story.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
That's to good. This day, when I talked to him, man, I said, you know, I still think you called me. And he's like, no. But
he
that
kind of
just reaffirms that the spiritual life has been in existence ever since I came down the birth canal.
Yeah.
You know, but I was
even
living.
Even before, probably.
For me.
Yeah.
You know, but I was spiritually asleep.
Yeah.
You know, even though I was walking around with my eyes wide open, I didn't wake up until having worked these 12 steps.
Yeah. There's something about the process of facing yourself and going through that because when we talk about things spiritual, sometimes there's this term called spiritual bypass. Have you heard of this?
No.
So spiritual bypass is basically... I have all these issues. Yeah, I have all this stuff. Yeah, I've been asleep for all these years and I've done all these things. But through prayer and a spiritual experience, I can bypass working through all of that. Mm. I can go over all that. And now I'm just new. I'm brand new. None of that exists anymore. I'm a new creation. And et voila, let's go live this life.
Mm.
Without doing the reconciliation work of... what the steps does, which is takes you on a journey to be able to face the things of the past, to face parts of yourself that you don't like, to deal with it, to confess it to another person. And so the concept of spiritual bypass is like, oh, I don't have to do all that. Because spirit is doing all, has done that already.
Yeah. Well, that's if you're only going to be working with the spirit,
right?
You know what I mean? Because ultimately, our charge is to help another sick and suffering alcoholic.
Right.
You know what I mean? And the way that we found that works, the pathway to that, is all that nasty, disgusting stuff you went through to get here, it now becomes an asset.
Right.
You know, where you can share that with somebody just so that they can understand that it's possible to recover from drugs and alcohol.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I'll reflect something that will resonate with that person.
Right.
If I bypass that, then I don't know if my experience enters in.
Right.
You know what I mean? And experience is a most vital part of helping another person get out of that deep, dark
hole.
You know what I mean? How can they tell me how to get out of a hole? That's like, you know, that's like people learning about recovery in a book, you know, with no practical, real knowledge of it.
Yeah.
And now I want to sit down with an addict and tell them that, you know, all you need is willpower.
Right.
You know, that's where these types of concepts come from. You know, you really just got to strengthen your willpower and you can get over anything. You know, I can't validate that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I can bring some experience about, you know, some suffering. You know, I can bring some experience about some near death.
Yeah.
I can bring some experience about some sick thoughts and actions, you know what I mean? I can bring some experience about some criminal behavior, you know what I mean? And some, if not all of that, has valid actual effectiveness in discussing recovery with another alcoholic.
And it has value now.
Absolutely, right now.
Because you faced it at some point in your recovery journey. And when we say face it, we mean you wrote it down.
Mm-hmm. And talked about it.
And then you talked about it. Mm-hmm. And then you prayed about it.
And prayed about it.
There's a process to kind of that cleansing process. Mm-hmm. I had a counselor had me do called a trauma egg. Have you heard of a trauma egg?
That I've heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you kind of write this little circle. Mm-hmm. And then you draw pictures of these traumatic events in your life. And... yeah, I did that. We had a morning session. We did it. And then I should have canceled the rest of my meetings for the day.
Yeah, from there, you're mush.
I did not. I did not. And I had a major issue in a meeting with a client after that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, in retrospect, I probably should have just canceled my appointments because I just relived every single traumatic event in my life.
Yeah.
And then I tried to just keep it moving, like my body didn't.
I'm all right.
Yeah, I'm good. Well, that felt
Let's
great.
Let's go get some eat.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I know that feeling because I've gone through that process as well. You know, there came a time in my using when my house got shot up and my wife's aunt got killed in my living room, shot through the head, and really tore down the whole. You know, my whole belief system came tumbling down in that moment. I didn't even recognize it at the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it was cloaked in all sorts of other things like revenge and, you know, street stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But once I arrived in recovery, I got to this place where I was willing to look at that with different lenses and discuss it with someone, you know what I mean? Because really I felt like an outcast afterwards because I've hurt that event hurt so many people.
Yeah.
You know, close to family members,
right.
You know, and did some damage, I think, to my marriage as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I didn't in the beginning recognize all that, you know, because directly after all that happened, a month or so later, I moved from New York, and I left my wife there to sell the house and then follow.
Yeah. You know?
But when I moved, I still dragged around that stuff, you know, and it was tumbling around in my head for months, you know. Yeah. And that's the reason I believe. That's the reason that I continue to binge use and you know, and I found myself in a situation one night where I was at work and I was working for Equifax, you know, and all day I couldn't really see right, you know, everything was like in a prism, colors kept popping in and out, and you know, and I just eventually I told my director that I needed to go because something's going on, and. And I left, and it was like 7 o'clock. I was supposed to leave, I think, at 10 that night.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like 7 o'clock. I left early, and I got on to 85, then 285. And at that time, I was living in Stone Mountain. And I remember passing the Vista Tucker. And once I passed the Vista Tucker, my right eye just went black.
Oh.
Just black. I couldn't see. And it was like seconds, right? And my left eye went black.
Oh, snap.
And I'm on 285 driving totally blind. And last I remember looking at my speedometer, it was like 65, 70 miles an hour. And I'm from New York. We pull over to the right, right? But for whatever reason, I don't even know why that this is important, but I pulled over to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And I found my phone in my briefcase and I called 911 and I told them by this time, I'm crying like a little girl.
Yeah.
Right? I can't see. I can't see. And they were like, where are you? And I said, the last sign I saw was La Vista Tucker, and I was heading into Stone Mountain. And a little while later, I heard a knock on the window, and it was the EMTs. And I put the window down, and he said, what's going on? And I said, I can't see, you know. I don't know why, but I can't see. And he says, all right, well, undo your seatbelt and we'll pull you through the window. And I was like, pull me through the window? The door works. He's like, yeah, but you're about an inch away from the median.
Oh.
You know what I mean? And I think now that I look at that with different eyes, I think that God wanted me to know that he was there with me.
Mm.
You know what I mean? That if I had pulled over to the right, it would have been easy access. No message would have been conveyed right then.
Right.
But every time I think about this is that this guy, this EMT, is talking to me from laying on a median.
Yeah.
Talking into my car. And he tells me that he has to take me through the window because the door is about an inch away from the median.
Right.
You know what I mean? Unable to see it at that time, you know, in the spiritual sight. But looking back at that, understanding exactly what's being done right there is God saying, I'm right here, man.
Yeah.
I'm right here. You know,
right.
I'm guiding you. So they pulled me out the window and they carried me for a little while. And I remember them putting me on a gurney and the ride was bumpy. That means I was on the real side of the road, right? And they put me in the ambulance, and I could feel them putting stuff on me and, you know, pricking me and stuff. And the EMT goes, "Damn." And I was like, "Damn,
that's you don't want to hear." No, you don't want to hear a doctor or an EMT say, "Damn."
No, that is never good. And I said, "What does damn mean?" And he said, "He says your blood sugar is at 866." Mm-hmm. And I said, "So
what does that mean?
The high score? Right. What does that mean? Right?
Do you win something?
What comes with that?" So he says, "No, we need to get you to the hospital right now before you stroke out."
Oh, snap.
Yeah. And once at the hospital, they put me in this treatment room, and this 866 number kept popping up in my head. And one of the nurses came in, and I said, what does the number 866 mean as it regards to my blood sugar? She said, "Well, normal blood sugar is between 75 and 150.
Oh.
Right?
Whoa.
I said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah." She said that that is a sure indication that something traumatic is about to happen. She said she's known people to have strokes with 600.
Oh.
Right.
So
once again, I'm here in the hospital, and I'm waiting. I'm blind as a bat. I'm crying like a little girl. Call my mom. Because that's what we do.
Right.
All right? When anything traumatic occurs to a man, he wants his mother.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, recently George, when he was down there with that knee on his neck.
Right.
You know.
Calling for his mom.
Calling for his mom. Yeah. And I understood that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I understood that. And eventually she came, and I remember the doctor coming in, and I could hear papers rustling and stuff. And he asked that alcoholic question. He's like, "Miss Abrams, do you drink a little at all?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, a few beers, game is on, you know." I always put it has to be a reason, right?
Yeah, right.
And he says, "Okay." And he said, "What about street drugs? Do you use any street drugs?" And I was like, "This motherfucker trying to get in my business." You know, I felt that way, you know?
Right.
Like he's trying to step into my affairs.
Yeah.
But I said, "Yeah, you know, I smoke a little weed, you know."
Yeah, right.
Game is on.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I can hear the papers rustling. And he's like, "Well, can you explain the mescaline and the cocaine that we find in your blood?" And then I did that thing that alcoholics and addicts do.
What's that?
I told him to leave me the fuck alone and go help somebody who needs his help. Huh. You know what I mean? I'm good. You know what I mean? Leave me alone. And I believe that's what we do. Yeah. When there are people in our sphere that are reaching out, "Yo, I can help you."
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're not ready, you're not ready.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't hear anything that man has to say.
Yeah.
You know, even if he says that you're killing yourself, you're blind. You know, I'm sitting there blind as a bat, and I'm scaring him.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the perspective change didn't occur for like 9 months.
Really?
Because that night, they admitted me into South DeKalb Hospital.
Yeah.
And they told me that I would have to learn a different way of living. I'd have to learn how to live as a blind person. And I had to like wrap my mind around that. And I was really trying, but I couldn't. I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't stop crying out for my mom.
Yeah.
And, one of the things I can tell you, man, is that I put my mom through some heavy stuff.
Your mom's around at this time?
Yeah, my mom's.
Okay.
Both my mom and dad are around.
Okay.
You know what I mean? But my mom has always been like my biggest cheerleader, man.
Right.
No matter what, going to jail and everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Were they in New York or at this time? They
were here.
Okay.
You know, they were the reason that I came down here because they saw what happened in New York on CNN.
Like, right.
And my mom called. And she's like, "Look, you're on the news, and this can't happen." You know, she's like, "You need a new beginning."
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And because my wife refused to go back to the old house, you know, she went and lived with her mom. And because the old house was a crime scene, we couldn't re-enter it. And my wife was like, I don't want nothing that's there.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Because blood was everywhere.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
You know what I mean? And the smell, it was just horrendous.
Yeah.
You know, so by the time I decided to leave New York, my wife had already decided that she wasn't going back to the house, so we had to sell it.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah. Coming down here made sense because my parents had a house down here.
Right.
So I came down here. And this was what followed.
Right.
You know, this is the kind of stuff that they had to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, so like I had been there for 2 or 3 days and my mom brought my radio and some reggae music because, you know.
Yeah, right.
That's what's needed, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm in this room.
Two little birds outside my doorstep. Hey. Yeah. Right.
Everything's going to be all
right. Right.
Anyway, I'm sleeping and I get a needle prick in my arm, and I wake up automatically opening my eyes, and I see like this little white dot, like just a little something. I could, like someone moving, I can see.
Wow.
You know? And that's what I told her. I said, nurse, I think I could see you. And she said, what? And I said, I think I could see you. She said, hold on, let me go get the doctor. Mm. And she ran, got the doctor, and the doctor came. You know, they got that big ass bright light.
Yeah.
Shunned that into my eyes. And he said, Mr. Abrams, he says, you were truly a miracle. I said, why? He says, 85% of the people that come in here with diabetic blindness leave with diabetic blindness.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
He said, but it seems that it was a glucose buildup behind your retina, and it prevented light from getting through. Had it stayed that way, I would have been permanently blind.
Wow.
He says, you're a miracle.
Yeah.
Right? And as the day progressed, more and more of my vision came back.
Yeah.
You know, I never wore glasses then, mm-hmm. you know, but afterwards I require glasses now.
Yeah.
But that day, I called my dealer and I said, yo, can you make a delivery to South DeKalb Hospital?
Yeah.
I got a room, I got music, TV, you know?
Right.
I felt like, you know, why not, right?
Yeah.
So he said, yeah, all right, I'll be there in 15:20. All right. So I got two IV poles connected to me, right? I got this gown with my ass out, right? And I got these yellow socks that they give you,
right.
You know? So I scoot up the bed, and I climbed over the back, and I picked the poles up, and I snuck past the nurses.
Yeah.
I got to the elevator. I was on the fourth floor, and I got to the elevator, and I went down to the parking lot, and I'm standing there with these two poles. And my man pulls up and he looks at me and he took off.
Oh.
And I'm like screaming, you know, screaming his name. And he's like, kept going.
Yeah.
So now I'm pissed.
Right.
So I'm getting the elevator. I don't even care how much noise these poles make. And I was like, wah, 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 right past the nurse's station.
Yeah.
And I go into the room and I call him up and I said, dude, I know you saw me, man. He's like, yeah, man, I saw you.
Yeah,
he said,
he did.
Troy, let those people help you, man. And this is the second miracle that I've experienced
mm-hmm.
because I know dope dealers real well. I know dope dealers that serve pregnant women and children.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But here I got a dope dealer that refused to serve
right.
me.
Right.
You know?
You get the dope dealer with the conscience.
when does that happen?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. He's like, nah, I don't need that 50 that much.
Right.
Right.
But what I understand today is that God can use anybody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a God thing, I think. And all doubt has been removed for me, you know? Because, I still kept using after I left the hospital, but I kept using with a different type of understanding that something was happening.
Yeah, there was a conviction now that wasn't there before.
Right.
Yeah.
Something was happening.
Yeah, and now when you look back on those times.
I understand.
Now you see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the God consciousness, you know. You get that consciousness, and then it's this whole universe opens up, and you see it all and you go, oh, now
seeing,
I get it.
Seeing it is one thing, but you got to walk into it.
You got to experience it.
Yeah.
Yes.
You got to walk into it. You have to live it. And it says it in the book, now we are in the realm of the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's a whole different place. You have left that place you were before. Right. You have not forgotten it, where you came from, but you have left it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And now you're bound by other things. You know, you're connected in other ways.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And for me, that was the crossroads. I had to really get enough courage to walk into a room and raise my hand.
Yeah.
And say, my name is Troy, and I got a drug and alcohol problem.
Right.
And that happened down here in Alpharetta. I was the only black kid. I was the only black person in the room.
Right.
You know? And I walked in there, and I remember my first meeting, my wife went with me.
Yeah.
She held my hand up each one of them stairs. And once I got up the stairs, she opened the door, and she said, go ahead in. I'm not coming in with you. And I said, no, I need you to come in here and sit with me.
Said, this part you do on your own.
No, she came. She sat
with me. She did?
She's that first meeting, she came and sat with me.
Wow.
Yeah. And I remember raising my hand and saying, hello, everybody. My name is Troy. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And this is my first AA meeting. And she saw that she didn't need to be there anymore. They kind of took over.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know? And they didn't care. They didn't care that I was 6'1". They didn't care that I was, you know.
Black and beautiful.
Beautiful black man from New York, you know.
Right.
They didn't care about any of that.
Right.
You know, all they cared about is that I was willing to do what they did.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's powerful, man. And I think that's kind of the sweet story of recovery, right? That we are all on. That's the anonymity portion, is when we are all together, our bank account, our status in the community, our race, our creed, our religion, none of that means anything. When we're all sitting in that room together, we're all on level ground.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We're all, well, not all of us are sober at that time, but you know, a lot of us are in that room.
Well, I mean, you know, you're in the room with sick people.
Yeah.
So expect some stuff.
Right.
But I believe that the biggest message is that you're welcome.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're welcome to sit with the rest of the sick ones. You know what I mean? I mean, I've been called nigger in the room. You know, I've had the experience of having fights in the room.
Oh, you know,
having to knock people out. And once that was done, I felt so horrible, but it was self-defense.
Yeah.
You know? But I also took away from that recovery is worth fighting for.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
This is your recovery, and you deserve to be in this room.
Yeah.
Right.
Recovery is worth fighting for.
Yeah.
You know? And the time that someone called me that N-word, I didn't have a fight that night. Everybody else rallied around me, man, and guys were like, picked him up, took him downstairs, took him outside, told him not to come back.
Wow.
You know what I mean? The time I had a fight in this room, I think I had like 8-9 years, and someone threatened me, you know, and as I was leaving, he came running up behind me before I got to the car.
Yeah.
And, you know, I defended myself.
Yeah.
You know,
was that a race thing, you think?
No.
No.
I'm a drug and alcohol counselor, and he was one of my former clients.
Yeah.
You know, and had to kick him out several times. And he walked into a meeting, he saw me, and he had some old resentments, and he felt he would take it out on me.
Yeah, he needed that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But I caught him real nice, right? But it ruined my hand. It has never gone down.
Back, right.
But
yeah, I've had that too. I have one on my right hand. Same thing. Yeah.
But when he woke up, he got up and ran right in front of the Alpharetta group, the old Alpharetta group, which used to be on Highway 9 and Roswell Street, and said, "Spiritual Troy, punch me in the head! Spiritual Troy!" Like, and people are like, what?
Spiritual Troy? Was that your old moniker?
No, that's the one he put on me.
Oh, you know? He put it on you.
Nah, that's Spiritual Troy. Yeah. I wouldn't go for that.
Yeah.
You know, that moniker wouldn't be something I can maintain. Right.
One of the things we were saying before we hit the record, you know, we were talking about race and bringing up race, and it's the topic right now we can't hide from, you know. Right. And one of the things, what you said, which was so profound, was that you had rage, and now because of your, first off, when I brought this up and I was like, here are the topics I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you know, and then I'm like, you're a black man in recovery and you're in service to mankind. Cause that's how you live your life, you know? And I know you pick up all them calls and you deal with all that drama and you're doing all those things. And so, but you said that you're kind of, there's been some reconciliation within you that's allowed you to see things a little different now because of the work you've done and because your own recovery requires such a connection to God that doesn't have room for hate or justifiable anger, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, what's your experience now and your view of this as it, and differently from what it was before this God consciousness, before this idea that God is love and that, and what our program says, that justifiable anger is left to other more spiritual people. We can't hold anger like that, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I believe that there are levels. You know, what has happened, you know, what happened to George Floyd is just... I mean, it moved me to tears to watch that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's still, if I see it now, it'll move me to tears. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I believe that that in itself.
I'll move the mic broke, up. Yeah.
Broke down some barriers.
Well, even watching that after watching Ahmaud Arbery,
mm-hmm.
which was another tremendous, mm-hmm. you know, it's like. I watched both of those once, and I'm like, I can't, like, there's no reason to relive that moment again.
Right. And, you know, and some of us have been watching it for a long, long time, those types of events.
Just not on video.
Oh, on video.
Yeah, and on video, right.
Yeah, on video and in the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it really has an effect on us. It has an effect on all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we talked about this a bit before we started recording, but, you know, I think that original sin of slavery has left some of this in its wake.
Yeah.
You know, and what makes sense to me is that that slave owner and that slaver...
Yeah.
That slaver, that person who had slaves, you know, was also affected by slavery.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like the slave was affected by slavery, you know, and the effect that it has brought upon the slaver or the slave owner is this poisonous, toxic mindset of superiority.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it has trickled down all these generations still, you know. Just like the damage for the slave has trickled down all these generations still.
Yeah.
So to get some understanding around that was, for me, a hell of a rage overcoming, you know, because I go to rage when I get, you know, this one-sided perspective.
Yeah.
But in order for it to... makes sense, I also had to view it from the slaver's perspective as well.
Right.
Just to get to a point of understanding, you know, how does it continue over all these generations?
Right.
You know what I mean? Well, what I had to do was to talk to some older black folks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they will share their stories freely.
Yeah.
And share their anger and their rage too. Yeah. I've got some of that.
Yeah.
You know. What's true too is that at these dining room tables, the slavers, what do you call it? Descendants.
Yeah.
Are really having that same type of exchange as well.
Yeah.
So in order for this healing to begin, it has to be holistic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We right. both all have to be in that same room.
Yeah.
And we all have to share our experiences around this original sin.
You know? Yeah.
Because it's like radiation. You know what I mean? It still permeates our organs, our inner being.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, and it sticks with us. It stays with us.
And it's doing damage.
Yeah.
It's clear. It's clear that it's doing damage.
On both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, we, you know, the idea that, like you said, the slaver has to heal from the harms. Because that sense of entitlement, power, right? I mean, that's, from a spiritual sense, that is a burden to bear.
And false.
Yeah. The idea that I'm better than anyone else because of the melanin, the skin color.
Right. Now, haven't you ever told a lie that you will never, ever confess to, never admit to, never give in to?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Well, that's what it is as it flows through these generations, you know? Not knowing. At some point, it becomes somebody's truth after a while.
Yeah.
This lie that you've been telling becomes somebody's truth.
Right.
You know?
Subliminally, subconsciously, it becomes that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then it's hard to see. Mm-hmm. That's what I was telling someone about that. It's like there are a lot of white people who just don't understand racism because we've never had to deal with it in the same way. Just like most Americans don't understand having to walk 2 miles to get water from a dirty little pond and bring it back
to
the village so that you and your kids can drink that water. Mm-hmm. We don't get that. Mm-hmm. The same way that white people really don't get racism because we've never really truly experienced it. And until today, we've been able to turn it off.
Mm-hmm. But now you could.
Now we can't turn it off.
You can't escape it.
It's on every freaking corner. And that's the power about what's happening now with the amount of protests. Mm-hmm. The blinders are off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that said, there's next step stuff that we have to do. And I love the fact that we are marching. I love that. You know what I mean? But what gets conflated with the marching is the violence and rioting.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's not us. That's not the message we want.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I think that a lot of that was fueled by the hesitation to charge the other police officers involved.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I think that fueled a lot. And you know.
Well, it's like you said, there's this in the same way that denial kind of exists for the slaver, right? Mm-hmm. There's a level of denial, you know, that it's this pent up frustration, you know.
Rage.
Mm-hmm. That's sitting there under the surface that says, okay, it's fine. I'm not going to trip. Okay, whatever, you know, this situation, which I'm sure you have plenty of examples of how you've experienced racism. And it's like, okay, I'm not going to do nothing. It's fine. I'm just going to keep it moving. You tell somebody about it and you keep it moving. But a little bit of that residual stays there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you watch someone who looks like your uncle or your brother or your cousin or your daddy get killed on film.
And you were teetering.
And you've been,
you just you've got been trying to hold Ahmad. It together.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then comes this release. I mean, the phrase that's been coming in my mind often is that redemptive violence is a fallacy.
Hmm.
Right? America loves redemptive violence.
Very much so.
But when you hate, you create more hate.
Mm-hmm.
You end up feeding into this system. But it's like you're able to sit here today and have this conversation on a level because of all this internal work you've done. And because of all that work and because of a conscious contact with God, you're able to see it through this lens of love. There's necessary work. I think I shared that. I shared with you that quote before we started recording, which is that power without love is abusive, and love without power is sentimental. And this is the blessing of the program of recovery.
Yeah,
is we get to see it and go, okay, let's do something. What can we do?
Yeah.
Let's get busy.
I think we are entering into the real reconstructive period.
Yeah.
You know, because this society is built on violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a violent place to live in the United States. It is, right? Even though people say that, you know, oh, where would you rather live? You know, there are some other more peaceful places than the United States.
Yeah.
You know, but I love this place.
Yeah.
And in that love, I believe that there is a modicum of let's try to rebuild this.
Yeah.
Because we can do so much good with this.
Yeah.
You know. But what's also involved here is willing participants, allies, and opposition.
Yeah.
You know, we have to have willing participants.
Yeah.
But what paralyzes us is fear. Yeah. Some whites think that what we're looking for is revenge, but really all we're looking for is equality.
Yeah,
you know, revenge doesn't is not a necessary, at least for me, it's not a necessary something that we need to attain.
Yeah.
You know, I think we can reconstruct a new way of viewing and dealing with each other.
Yeah,
you know, which would enable us all to walk away alive.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And my life is worth living.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It is.
Even though I would put it on the line, you know, for my kids. And this is really what we're talking about here. What are we leaving for our kids?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's the thing I've noticed with my kids. My kids are like teenagers, 12, 13, 19. And their view of race is different than even mine. Like, well, I grew up in California. So, you know, I grew up having Mexicans are around all the time, you know, black people around all the time. Like, I grew up with a integrated into. So I love it. I love black people. I miss Mexicans in Georgia because there's not enough that I see and interact with. I miss the culture. I worked 11 years, you know, with Steve Harvey and them. And I miss that culture of working with black people because there's just a certain level. Well, the way I always say it is that working with black people, a black person will say, fuck you.
I love you up.
Let's go to lunch. A white person will say, let's go to lunch. And then talk around your back after lunch. That's was my experience. But see, because I've been exposed to a diverse culture, it's helped me to understand and to see, right? Because I've had those experiences. I've had so many positive experiences with people of color that I love people of color.
You see, that love that you possess needs more love.
Yeah.
You know, love is in need of love right now. That's why we are seeking allies.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because not every interaction is a negative interaction.
Right.
You know, and I think it bears mentioning, you know, that we can actually add to each other's lives, you know.
Right. But then you have people who have white people who have had a predominantly negative experience with people of color.
Of course.
That's just been, you know, it's all in their experience, right? Which is the thing that they're like trying to, if they're an honest person, you have a conversation with them, you can hear the honesty. And well, my experience has been that it's always, you know, a white guy will always at least try to pay me back. And the black guy always try. At my experience, that's their experience. That's
okay.
Right.
And we got to make room for that. Right.
Right.
Right now, there's a whole cultural shift going on in Asia, in China predominantly, where black people are being excoriated and kicked out.
Oh, word.
Yeah. And it's a heavy lift to watch. you know? But I can't speak to that because that's not my experience.
Right.
It's only news. It's only information I'm getting on the news.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
What I'm speaking about today is my experience.
Exactly.
And how I can use this experience, because now we're charged with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This is the time is right.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, let's talk about it.
Right.
You know, I can't talk about a black man in China having the experience that they're having, but
right.
I can certainly talk to you about a black man in America
having
the experience that he's having.
Exactly. And that's what's happening. We've been having, you know, you can't get on a phone or on a conversation, you know, without this thing coming up. And the thing that's interesting about racism is that word racism is packed with so many things, like education, you know, income inequality, inequality,
real estate,
mm-hmm.
the value of a white person's house versus the value of a black person's house,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a black neighborhood or a white neighborhood, same exact house,
right?
But the values are different,
right?
Why is that? Now, these are systemic racist. Yeah. ways of approaching it, right?
Yeah.
Because the racist, the true racist has power. That's why that's why we feel it.
Right.
They have power.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So what we must do is level the playing field where the power is not what we're looking at right now. What we're looking at is a structure of mm-hmm. equality.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That's why you hear fuck the police.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not about them. Yeah, we know they got guns. We know they, you know, yeah. But let's put them on some equal ground.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, and you know, it's the thing that I'm like, if you talk to anybody who's like a sociologist and you look at the history of societies as they're built, most societies have a undercarriage, like a disproportionate. They have this portion of the society that is the less fortunate, that is the one that is taken
subculture.
Advantage of, this subculture. Mm. Every society in humankind has had that.
But is that the rule?
Well, and that was a part of the conversation. It's like, can we evolve as a human species to create a system, you know? Because when you hear things like level the playing field, you know, people go to like these extremes with it, you know, and that's the thing for me. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's in our lifetime. I think of like Star Trek, you know, like all these motherfuckers in a plane and like they don't have money exchanging anymore. Like
it's all an
honor based society.
We've grown past that.
And they've grown all past that. And you got aliens, you got people with stuff growing out their face, and they're all accepting them.
Hey,
and
what up?
Right. Right. That's what I'm thinking. Like, are we going to get there? I don't know. As a species, maybe we'll get there.
Well, it's an ideal hope, you know. And
yeah.
I think isn't it worth going for?
It's worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it worth going for? I mean, even though it's idealistic, it is not toxic.
Right.
You know what I mean? And really, what we're trying to do here is to really cleanse a lot of, you know, past, you know, stains that are still out there.
Yeah.
You know, what's particularly important, I believe, is that readiness to try.
Yeah.
You know, let's try some stuff, some new stuff we never tried before.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's the same in recovery. You know, I have to see me do some things that I have never seen me do before.
Right.
In order to recover from drugs and alcohol. Well, in order to recover from the trauma of slavery and inequality and racism, there's some stuff that we each have to see ourselves do that we ain't never seen ourselves do before.
We need the 12 steps of racism.
Of life.
Because, like, it is a spiritual malady, racism. Racism is, right? It's
a
spiritual malady. And when somebody kind of, when you've been through hell and you come back from hell and you do like what you've been doing this whole time, you're looking back at all these moments that you thought were hell, but were actually moments of God's grace just pouring out on you. it changes your perspective. But if you've never gone through hell, it's hard to really see it. But that's what we're ultimately treating an addiction as, this spiritual malady. And that's what racism ultimately is.
Yeah, really what simplified it for me is, you know, viewing it this way is like, you know, you don't really appreciate a good summer, beautiful summer, unless you've gone through a fucked up winter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then you say, oh my God, this is a beautiful day.
Right.
You know, what a beautiful day this is. Man, we're walking out of this, you know, nasty, disgusting,
right,
cold weather into right. This warm sunlight of the spirit.
Yeah. You know, the thing that it's in seminary, and then also like with the 12 steps, is there's a portion of what is mine to do, right? Like, I'm willing to surrender my will to God. That's mine to do. No one can do that for me. I have to do that surrendering, right? And my experience will keep encouraging that surrendering. And every time I may not want to surrender, but every time I surrender, my life's better for it,
yeah.
Right? And it's I think it's the same thing with this issue here, is about people, each individual person, black or white, brown or not, what is yours to do today,
yeah,
literally.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that, like, for me, like with what we're doing, what's mine to do is like, I how can we get more people of color to share, to be on here, to talk, so that we can see that you are me, Troy.
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah.
And I am you.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. And the more exposed people can see that, they go, oh, you know, we're really, there's this thing that's happening between us that's deeper than any kind of earth suit or physical form that we've mm-hmm. all chosen to take at this point in time, right? Right. Something deeper and better is going on. And what is yours to do today?
Right.
And if it's simple, if it's small, you know, whatever it is.
Or even if it's hard.
Even if it's hard.
You know what I mean? I don't think that there are degrees to this. I believe that, you know, we've been imbibed with a certain amount of courage to do the next right thing.
Right.
It doesn't say the next thing that makes you feel right. You know what I mean? It's the next right thing.
Yeah.
And that may sometimes require some courage.
Yeah.
You know, and some wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, and I definitely want to, you know, enable each of us to maybe think outside the box.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely want to speak to that possibility,
yeah,
that we can create some new structures that don't really have a negative impact on each other's culture the way that, you know, some of the stuff has. You know, because we can bring some real blessings to each other's culture if we just recognize that God's got us all in his hands.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is just recognizing God and his deal and how he has created all of us just for the purpose of this thing. Come together.
Yeah.
You know, love each other. Let's see if you can do it. Because you ain't been doing a good job over the last, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Absolutely, man. One last thing I know that I kind of feel like I want to say is that there's, in the Hebrew tradition from many years ago, that the concept of the word God, like they didn't really write the word God down because it was so sacred. And that there's an equivalent to the name of God that's equivalent to like breath and breathing, right? And that's one thing that we all are doing, right? Breathing. God has built that system in us all, whether we're thinking about it or not. But once you start to think about it,
mm-hmm.
that's when the change occurs. Once you breathe in, you breathe out, and you pay attention to it, mm-hmm. and you acknowledge it, now there's you kind of, something happens there. And I think that's, In a sense, what this whole country is kind of being right now. We're all being forced to pay attention to our breath and what we're breathing in, because George Floyd can't breathe, but we can.
Yeah.
And what are we going to do?
Yeah.
We can breathe for him. What are we going to do with our breath now? Right? Mm.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with that next breath that you take?
Yeah.
You know? Who are you going to help with it?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that doesn't make... That doesn't make life a bunch of daisies and sunflowers.
Tiptoeing through the tulips.
You know what I mean? It's an unrealistic expectation.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Some of us, I think we're all going to get there, but some of us are going to come up the rough side.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, it's going to require some of us to exhibit some tolerance and some patience.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, as this work is not easy.
What's encouraging to me is that, you know, this program of recovery, like you said that first day, you know, and you raised your hand, and that everybody just saw you as, okay, this is another one of us coming into the fold. And that's such a powerful illustration. And I'm glad that's your experience. And I know it's not everyone's experience.
Yeah.
And sometimes what we face when we're in those situations is we're facing, like, when we walk into that, like, you were in a point when you walked into that room. You tell me if this is true. Where it didn't matter that everybody was white in that room.
Yeah, sure.
Everyone could have been freaking purple. You were there because you knew you needed the help you needed to get. It didn't matter who was in there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know what I mean? That's why it's so important as I work with people.
Mm-hmm.
I understand some things, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that really I must understand is that I am not here to interfere with you hitting the bottom you need to hit.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because that's what I had to do. I had to hit that bottom so I can walk into a room full of white people and ask for help. And if you know me, that in itself,
right?
You know, speaks volumes to the willingness that you had bottom, the value of a real good bottom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I don't interfere with people of hitting the bottom they need to hit, you know?
Yeah.
If I'm working with a guy and he continues to relapse, then, you know, what I usually say is that, you know, guys rarely get the voice to fire me. I usually have to say, you fired me, you know what I mean? You have fired me, you know, by the way that you're not listening to what I'm offering you. You're not,
yeah.
you're not being truthful. You're not being transparent. You fired me. Go find someone, either go find a bottom, which will enable you to allow what we talk about to be something strategic and something that you're willing to implement into your life, or, you know, go find another man that you might be willing to listen to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let's not waste time here. Life is precious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and every time you're spending on the phone with somebody who's just kind of...
I could be working with somebody else.
You could be working with someone who needs it.
And they can be working with someone else. Someone that they can hear. Not everybody's going to hear Troy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Not everyone's going to respond to me. Even though they may think they might, since I'm the one with the time, I'm going to say, yeah, well, I just made a suggestion to you a couple of days ago and you haven't done it. What's going on?
Right.
Oh, yeah, all right, I'll do it. Oh, all right, another week goes by. How long are we going to continue this?
Right.
You know, you're wasting time. You know,
yeah.
This is about your life.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Well, this has been good, man. This has been a really good conversation. What's cool is you're here. You're picking up your gear has been here, and you're about to set it up again and hopefully start doing some more clean dreams, which is such a blessing. And any time, like, somebody, especially when this whole COVID thing hit, you know, I kept telling people, man, hit up on Clean Dreams, because it's essentially like, you know, it's essentially a meeting. But here you got all this, you're reading from the solution, and then you're sharing your person. Everyone's sharing an experience from that solution.
Yeah.
And so if you can't get into a meeting or the Zoom thing was throwing you off, listen to this, you know, because there's some days, sometimes when you would come in, when everyone was coming in, we had the studio and everyone was coming in. I mean, there'd be 100, 150 years of recovery in a room.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, okay, that's who you want to listen to,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. You know, the value that I found with Clean Dreams is really something that is portable. You know what I mean? And you can just have it in your ear.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Some people can work with their headphones on. And if you're in recovery, you want to have any access to recovery possible.
Yeah.
And that's what we're offering at Clean Dreams. You know, if you're indeed sick and suffering like I was, you want to continue to hear the solution so that you know, inside of yourself that there's stuff, actions you can take. You know what I mean? Because what you hear is authentic alcoholism, authentic drug addiction, and authentic recovery.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
www.cleandreams.us, man.
Yeah.
Don't sleep.
Couldn't get that .com though, huh?
.com is expensive, bro.
It was like $9,000 for the .com.
.com is expensive.
Yeah.
But
yeah, man, this has been dope, dude. I don't know how long we've been on for. How long have we been on for?
125, so really like 115.
Ah, nice.
Not bad.
Yeah. Good stuff, man.
Yeah, man. I still want to remain connected to the Most High Show family, man. You know what I mean?
This always, is
family for me now.
Yeah.
You know, and as we go forward in our, you know, in our endeavors, whatever it is, I always think about you guys and how you've helped Clean Dreams to, you know, maintain. And, you know, if I haven't said it before, man, thank you, man.
Yeah,
thank
man.
You for
Appreciate
all that,
that
you've done. You've been a blessing to Clean Dreams, man. Both of you have.
Yeah.
You know, even Costa, man, I can't not say thank you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I really appreciate the blessing you guys have been, man. I see God in both of you.
And we see God in you, man. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, man.
All right. This is the Most High Show.
Yes.